everyone, and welcome to First Things First. We made it to Friday. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. This is Nick Wright. We got a great show for you today. The NBA All-Star captains were announced. Antonio Brown is ready for a trade, but we have to start with the big game next weekend, the Super Bowl. So Rams head coach Sean McVay celebrated his 33rd birthday yesterday, the youngest coach to lead his team to a Super Bowl. Among the other ways he celebrated, game planning against the best coach quarterback in NFL history. That coach is Bill Belichick. He's 66. McVay's 33. That age gap, the largest ever between Super Bowl head coaches. Here's what McVay had to say about facing New England.
It's a great challenge for our football team because these guys are the epitome of, you know, really the standard, the consistency at which you operate. And, you know, I think, you know, Coach Belichick, you know, he certainly has had a lot of success on defense, but he's been instrumental in offense, special teams. So, you know, his success speaks for itself. And I've said before, I'm a fan of coaching. I have so much respect for the Patriots organization, the way they operate, the way that he consistently leads, puts his players in positions to really have success. And then, you know, that's something that's it's an incredible opportunity for us to compete against them. Our players have earned the right to be able to play in this game. Our coaches have done a great job. And really, it's about the Rams versus the Patriots, doing an excellent job with that. But to get a chance to go against a team and an organization like this is something that we're excited about. But you have a lot of respect for them.
Guys, how many press conferences would it take Bill Belichick to have used that many words in an answer to any question ever? See, what is the biggest challenge facing Sean McVay and the Rams as they now get set and face the Patriots?
There's not one challenge bigger than the other, but there are a series of challenges when you're playing the Super Bowl, especially when you have the drastic difference in experience that you have with the Patriots versus the Rams. So from an organizational standpoint, the biggest challenge is how do I get to the weekend and get some of the business that has nothing to do with the game? All these players, I got four players got experience. All their families, everyone they went to high school with, college with, all these new friends you pick up. How do they get that organized? Because New England will have that part organized. So their biggest challenge is, how do I get through the first week and I don't lose the game in the first week? You know, your wife wants tickets. Her auntie wants tickets. How many people can go to the game? Hotels in Atlanta. All these things, I have seen teams lose the Super Bowl in that bye week leading up because they couldn't get organized. All these things became more important. How they're going to get their suit made. What are they going to do after they win? All these things. And then besides that, his next big challenge, I believe, is as a play caller, how does he generate big plays for Jared Goff against that rush that New England has, which I believe is the least talented of the four teams that we had left, and they generate the most amount of pressure with the least amount of talent. So, yes, the organizational part from an organization, that is very, very key. But from a football standpoint, how can he generate big plays against that pass rush of New England? And I believe they're going to have to do it a variety of different ways, but a lot of that's going to have to do with making Jared Goff comfortable, giving him some things that he likes to look at so he can deliver the football down the field. I believe that on the field is the biggest key with the other key off the field. Do they lose the Super Bowl in the prep week leading up to the Super Bowl?
And then even after you get through the prep week, how do you make sure that media day, which is unlike any media experience you've ever had in your life, you don't have any pitfalls there. Once the game starts, the Patriots know how to deal with that elongated halftime with the 30-minute halftime show because they've been there so many times. The Rams do not. So there are all those non-football things that the Patriots are better equipped for than any team in NFL history, and that the Rams are basically as unequipped as you can be with this little of experience. And then there's the X's and O's part, and there's the fact that Sean McVay has to be ready for Bill Belichick to present him with something that they have not shown on film at any point all year. I last night I was thinking, one of my good friends who I hadn't caught up with in forever is Ted Johnson, who played middle linebacker for the Patriots for their first three Super Bowl wins of this era. So he and I were talking about Belichick last night about things they did when they were in the final Super Bowl of his era, the 0-4 game against Philly. And he said all year long they'd played a 3-4. They hadn't come out a single game where their base defense was a 4-3. And in the Super Bowl against Philadelphia, they switched up in the week leading up to it, and they came out in a base 4-3 defense, and they could see that the Eagles had to throw out their initial script. They had to throw out what they were planning to do because they hit them with a curveball they were not expecting. Like we saw even in these playoff games, the Chargers were never able to adjust what the Patriots were doing. The Chiefs needed halftime to adjust, and their inability to get ready to get going in the first half cost them that game. Can the Rams adjust to whatever wrinkle Belichick is planning to throw at them earlier than the Chargers or the Chiefs were able to? That, to me, is an X's and O's part that's going to come down a lot to Sean McVay and Wade Phillips.
I was going to say, how much is Sean McVay going to rely on Wade Phillips, not just for his Super Bowl experience, but also for the X's and O's, that he doesn't have to really worry about every little detail? He knows Wade's been there and done that, and he can lean on him for the intangibles, not just leading up to, but the game itself.
Absolutely. That's one of the things about Sean McVay and talking to people who know him. Like, he's a guy who's very, very bright, but he doesn't shun against having other bright people in the room. And that's what one of the keys to his success. Him and the general manager, like, they've been on the same page as far as, man, we need certain things here. We need certain coaches here. I need certain players here. And normally, Les Snead or another general manager, they would be like, wow, this guy's too young. I can't bring in guys like Ndamukong Suh. I can't bring in guys like Peters. Like, I can't bring – he's not going to be able to control those guys. So they have made all the right steps to be able to support this young coach because you know what you know. And that offensive side of the football, man, that's the side he should be concentrating on. Wade is the voice of reason. He's the older guy in the room. And that whole defense, they have such tremendous respect for him no matter where Wade has been. So Wade has had success against Bill Belichick. I believe that McVay will lean on that success and try to figure out the offensive side and how I can generate big plays for Jared Goff.
And I know we're going to talk much more about Wade Phillips specifically later in the show, so I'm going to stay on the Sean McVay side of things. Can he create a wrinkle that throws the Pats off a little bit? C talked about using Jared Goff as a runner, having Jared Goff, if the Pats want to play a two-man with their corners turning and running away from the quarterback, can Jared Goff use his legs to add something? Because we know there aren't many things the Pats have had trouble with in the past, but a quarterback that can do that, that can cause them to make an adjustment they don't want to make. Is there something that Sean McVay has been able to almost hold in reserve that the Patriots won't have been able to study, that they won't have been able to see this is what they like to do in this spot that can throw them off? Because one of the strengths of the Rams has been Jared Goff has played well and they have a ton of talent, but there's also been plays that we have seen, especially after Cooper Kupp got hurt, where they are scheming guys open, where guys that are, whether it's Taylor Higbee, the little used tight end, the backup slot receiver, whomever it is, it's like, okay, that guy got open on Wednesday when they installed that play against this look. Are they going to be able to get a few free first downs because of what they do schematically, or is Belichick going to have the answers to the questions before he's asked them?
How much can McVay pull from what Doug Peterson did last year with the Eagles? Is that one of the games that he'll go back and just watch to see if the Patriots changed anything up for that game? Not that it'll do the same thing, but the way that that game plan was changed?
Well, typically in Patriots, in their Super Bowls, they get off to a slow start. Any information as far as watching film is valuable when you don't know anything. So I think that the big games that they've been in the last couple years, if you look at the Super Bowls, Philadelphia and Atlanta, neither one of these teams had experience. New England had the same type of experience edge over them in the coaching and in the player.
Personnel.
So there is information from these previous meetings, but ultimately it's about blocking and tackling. New England plays very, very conservative to start off these games to try to figure out what you're going to do. Can the Rams get off to a fast start? Because New England will be feeling out process. That's the way they play in these big games. They don't get off to fast starts like they do in those playoff games. The Super Bowl, they get off to a slow start. If you want New England, play them in the regular season early. In the Super Bowl, if you want to score some points, score early.
And to your point about what Philadelphia did, as we've discussed before, in the last decade, the Patriots have only lost one game in the playoffs where their offense was great, and that was last year's Super Bowl. When they have lost, it's been because their offense has been stymied or held down. So obviously, the Rams don't care how they win, right? They just want to win, and Wade Phillips is going to try to hold down the Patriots' offense. On McVay's side of things, he has to figure out, how can we win a game like that? If our defense isn't great, how can we do what Philadelphia did, which was
win despite their offense,
which was
well.
As unexpected. Philadelphia winning was an upset. Philadelphia winning the way they did was a massive upset. When we talked about that game, it was, if Philly's going to win, it's going to be because that front four is going to get to Brady. They're going to force turnovers. It wasn't going to be they're going to win a 41-33 shootout, which is what they did.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, one of the Patriots, Julian Edelman. Has he been the best wide receiver this postseason? That's next on First Things First. Welcome back. We'll get to the Patriots in a second, but first, Thunder, Pelicans from last night. Oh. AB. I mean, Abdul Nader, sorry, drives baseline, dunks all over Cheick Diallo.
Two-handed off the baseline. I thought he was going to rise up with one. Good job. And Cheick Diallo didn't know if he wanted to contest, take the charge, and said he gets boomed on.
More NBA Warriors in D.C. Steph Curry with some fancy moves before hitting the shot over Otto Porter.
Steph had an almost identical play in the first half on the other end of the court where he just dribble, and then little mid-range jump shot. He was spectacular last night.
Oh, yeah, great day for the Warriors. They stopped by and saw the former President Obama, spent some time with him.
Finally, Lord. College basketball, UCLA, whoa. Arizona State. That's Jalen Hands.
Oh, this is the nicest dunk of the year. Ooh. Oh, that's nasty right there now.
The only thing that competes with that, Ja Morant's had one, the kid from Murray State, and that high school kid that we saw a few weeks ago with the in-game.
Man, this is UCLA. This is in Poly, dog.
Yeah, with ooh. The short shorts. These
now,
kids
I do
these
miss
days
that.
With the short
living
shorts.
Living in L.A.,
man.
Going to Poly, playing basketball over at the other, at the rec gym. Dang. I used to have a life.
Moving on to the Patriots, the storyline has been the rotating cast of wide receivers that have come in and out of New England. Since returning in week 5, Julian Edelman has been a constant, though. The folks over at Pro Football Focus ranked Edelman the number one receiver this postseason. 247 yards on 16 catches and a postseason best 14 catches for first downs. All right, CeCe, what makes Edelman such an effective weapon in the Patriots' offense?
Well, I think the first thing you need to understand that in the Patriots' offense, that is the attack position. That's what they're trying to do, either throw the ball to that slot receiver, has nothing to do with Edelman, has everything to do with what they're trying to do. They figured out the passing percentages, where Tom Brady likes to throw the ball. They like to throw the ball straight down the middle of the field, and they like to throw it to slot receivers. Why? Because when you put guys in the slot, they have a three-way read that they can make at the top of the break. So it's more confusing for the defenders. It's the easiest position to play inside of an offense if you want to be able to get a guy open. It's harder to be able to double-team him there, be able to take things away from him. He's the blitz hot. So in doing that, that guy's going to catch a lot of balls. Guess who used to catch a lot of balls from? Troy Brown. He played in the same position with New England. He was the first guy in this Brady era to be able to take over that position. Then they went out and got a guy named Wes Welker, and he did it at an all-time high. And then after that, you know what they did? They moved Gronk in there, Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah.
And now, because he's not there anymore, then they went to Edelman to be able to develop him. So they're always going to have, in this offense, a guy in that position who has very, very reliable hands, very good short area quickness where at the top of the break, they can't get bogged down and can get in and out of their break. So typically, that's a smaller guy. And you need to be a smart football player. Edelman, coming from his days as a quarterback at Kent State, understanding coverages, being on the same page with Brady, him and Brady spend an extensive amount of time together. So I wouldn't necessarily agree that with Pro Football Focus, he was the best wide receiver in the playoffs. But that position in the Patriots is going to generate a lot of attention regardless what number, who the body is, and Edelman is that guy now.
And it has been a seamless year-to-year transition for the four names Chris mentioned. Troy Brown was there the first year of the Belichick-Brady era, was there through 06. Now, midway through that, he started playing some defensive back one season because they were shorthanded. But the year they won their first Super Bowl, Troy Brown was a nice player, but 100-plus catches, 1,200 yards, that's what they – I mean, that is – way over what any realistic production for Troy Brown would have been in a typical offense. Then Wes Welker, who Miami Dolphins couldn't figure out a way to use. Wes Welker, if you take a snapshot of his 6 years with the Pats, you'd say, Well, that's a Hall of Famer. Just if you just look at the stat sheet, you'd say, okay, so he averaged what? Oh, 1,200 yards receiving and 110 catches per season. While Wes Welker was finishing up, that's when they drafted Hernandez, and that's when it was a little different because you actually had an athlete playing that position when you hadn't in the past. And then Edelman. And so Edelman, it is when Chris says 99% of guys are system players, this is the definition of a system role. That if Julian Edelman were on a different football team, he'd still be on the football team. But the idea that we'd be talking, oh, has he been a better receiver this postseason than Michael Thomas, than Brandon Cooks, that it's would never happen. Now, where Edelman deserves credit is he has, I think, elite toughness, and he made a catch that might have swung a Super Bowl in that Atlanta game, an incredibly difficult catch while getting hit when the ball looked like should have hit the ground and it didn't. But guess what? If Brady does want to play till he's 45, and if in a year they move on from Edelman, we'll find another guy. There'll be another guy that puts up these similar numbers. And so I just think this is they're able to scheme them open with what they do. And this is something you can explain far better than me. What they do as far as motioning him and the way that puts the defense in a tough spot and the way it makes the defense tip their hand as to what defense they're playing, that if you tip your hand to Brady, you're drawing dead. And I feel like that's one of the ways they use Edelman the best.
Yes, a high percentage of the time, they'll condense the formation as far as tight ends and fullbacks and other wide receivers. They'll line Edelman up at the numbers or 2 yards outside the numbers, because when he lines up out there, it gives Brady an indicator what the coverage is going to be. So on the defense, if I'm facing the defense, if they put the cornerback from this side over on that side, I know it's man-to-man. If they put the cornerback who's supposed to be on the left, I know it's some type of zone. So I put him out there just as an indicator. I can't leave him out there. Why? He doesn't have the height, doesn't have the speed, doesn't have the skill level to be able to get open at the numbers or outside the numbers. So I motion him inside. Gronk is the number one wide receiver on New England. So I'll put him inside to get him hiding so I can release people off, and then he can come in behind him so he can use his short area quickness and be able to read the coverages. That's what New England tries to do time in, time out. When you watch the highlights, watch how many times in the field Brady is looking straight down the barrel of the defense, because that's where they want to be able to throw the ball, and that's where they try to manipulate to get these smaller receivers into that part of the defense.
And those third and tens against the Chiefs, the three third and tens in overtime. You had Hogan made a big play prior to the overtime in that spot.
Yeah, they just switched their responsibilities. Right. They ran the same play that Edelman got him for twice. Him and Hogan switched. Hogan beats him on the defense.
I mean, it's the same thing. And it also plays to the strengths and weaknesses of Tom Brady. One of the reasons that they like to do it up the pump seams, as you would call it, is because Brady, for how great he does not have the strongest arm in the league, certainly at this point in his career.
True.
So we think about passing only in yards vertically, but the field's 53 and a half yards wide, 53 and a third yards wide. When you are trying to go to the deep out, I mean, you can do the geometry equation, like you got to throw it a lot further. So what they will do is, and
not only you have to throw it further, you have to hold it longer. So part of their design is to get the ball out of Tom Brady's hand. He's got 90 dropbacks in the playoffs. Hadn't been sacked one time. Why? Because it's all part of the system that they run.
And this is where the Patriots and the college graduates and the smart players come into play. And this is why my partner was the most devastating slot receiver maybe in NFL history, because once you got moved to the slot, because you understood you had options.
Yes.
It wasn't just you are running 8 yards and going left. It's you're running 8 yards, and then you can choose reading the defense if you're going left, right, or I assume just turning around.
Yes.
And so you have to have a player that can know where the defense is soft spot is with how they're covering him. And then you add it to Brady, who can see the same thing. And that's where the synchronicity, I think is the word. That's when them being in sync. Let me say it like that. He knows he can trust Edelman is going to read the same thing he's reading. So he can throw it to him before he's even out of his break. And then you're basically drawing dead. That's why you don't have to have a 4.4 speed guy. You don't have to have a 6.3 guy. You just have to have a guy who can read that defense. It's why it's so tough to beat.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Wade Phillips. Coming up, are the Cowboys getting rid of Jason Garrett for Sean Payton? We discuss next on First Things First. This February, the greatest event in motorsports is back. The Daytona 500 kicks off the 2019 NASCAR season, February 17th on Fox. Time now for us to go viral. The Pro Bowl kicks off in Orlando on Sunday, showcasing the best of the best in the league. But before them, legends of the game paved the way with 11-time Pro Bowler Willie Nasty Rove tweeting out a picture of our guy CC in 2001 representing the NFC.
There's Warren Sapp, a mustachioed Warren Sapp. Is that Jesse Armstead being eclipsed by one Willie Rofe in the back there, see?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Look at that. That was, I feel like that was right after a mustachioed Chris Carter. Like, you had gotten rid of the stash. Warren Sapp had picked it up for you.
I got no clue. Big Sapp Daddy. McDaniel.
Oh, that's Randall McDaniel between the two of you guys? I didn't even recognize that.
Oh, yeah. Man, look at that. He's got a six-pack as a left guard.
You know who didn't have a six-pack?
Warren Sapp. Warren Sapp used that belly.
No, you don't need a six-pack, but he's great, though. You don't need no six-pack doing what he's doing. He belly bumping. He's belly bumping.
Willie Rofe had the roughest weekend, his two teams.
Ooh.
Saints and Chiefs. Thinks he's getting him in the Super Bowl. Gets neither.
Time for your AT&T wake-up call. We start with Antonio Brown, who continues to make headlines. Earlier this week, Steelers captain Marquise Pouncey said the team would welcome back AB. However, yesterday, AB tweeted that he is open for business. All right, CC, assuming that he is, which team would benefit most from AB?
Man, I don't know. I mean, he's a good wide receiver. There's a couple teams out there that need one. People talk about San Francisco. I think he should go to Jacksonville with Tom Coughlin.
Wait.
Just some good old-fashioned, just, hey, no
a
hats
camp.
On. Both your feet on the floor. No hoodies. All that. No fur coats. All that. That's where I think he should go. Tom Coughlin, call Pittsburgh. We got one of the best diva receivers for you.
This is a version of your kid misbehaved all school year, so you send him to the grandparents' ranch for the summer. I'm going to teach you some work.
Yep.
Send you to Grandpa Coughlin. I think San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. That's one of those rich people problems. Hey, kids, you're going away for camp in the summer. You got 6 weeks going nowhere. Yeah, I know about that. I got friends that do that to their kids all the time.
See, I think
San
Francisco does make the most sense. And I think AB, if it matters, would be the happiest there. I know that's not your concern.
Yeah, what I care about. He should be happy in Pittsburgh.
Yesterday was reported that Cam Newton had an arthroscopic procedure done on his right shoulder. This is the second shoulder surgery in 3 years now for Cam Newton. He had surgery to fix a partially torn rotator cuff in March of 2017. Nick, what did you make of the news?
Listen, it confirms what we all knew watching Cam Newton play and reading the reports after the season. He was, shortly after they got off that great start, was playing with a hurt shoulder. Then T.J. Watt really exacerbated the problem. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they're dealing with it early. I think that you don't have to be too concerned yet. But to me, you know how I feel about these things. He's one shoulder injury away from it being a significant concern for his career moving forward. You just hope Cam can get back to full strength because we know how good he can be when he is.
Yeah, I'm glad they were able to go in there compared to just trying to rehab it. That's something Andrew Luck tried to do a number of times. It didn't work. Then they eventually went in there and surgically repaired it. Happy for Cam. He's one of the best in the game. The game is better when he's playing at a high level.
All right, moving on to the NBA, where yesterday the starters for the All-Star game were announced. In the West, it'll be LeBron, KD, Paul George, Harden, and Steph. In the East, it's Giannis, Kawhi, Embiid, Kyrie, and Kemba. Nick, what do you think? Did the fans get the starters right?
9 of the 10. I'm very happy for Kemba Walker, by the way. He's getting some just-deserved credit and notoriety, even playing in Charlotte. The only one that I take issue with is I would have said Anthony Davis over Kevin Durant. You could argue Anthony Davis over LeBron because LeBron's missed time, but you knew LeBron was going to get more votes than anybody. Like, I think Anthony Davis had a better year than Kevin Durant, but in large part, these are 9 of the 10 I would have picked, given the two conference makeups.
The Pelicans, what's their record right now?
They're struggling.
Okay, are they in the playoff?
They're not, but it's not the MVP. It's the All-Star race.
Oh, I'm just trying to. No, I didn't ask you to explain that.
Okay.
Because fans have said you have to have two starters off the best team in the NBA. Now they've won 9 in a row. It's right. KD should be a starter. So it's a good problem to have in the West. You don't have a center. When you don't have a center, AD's going to miss out.
All right, moving on. Last week, we learned that Kyrie Irving reached out to his former teammate LeBron James. Among topics discussed, how hard it is to lead a team. He also apologized for not listening to LeBron when he was a younger player. Now Kevin Love is suggesting that Kyrie could potentially reunite with LeBron in L.A. Nick, could Kyrie actually team up again with LeBron James this summer?
I do not think people should dismiss this as a possibility. I would have dismissed it as a possibility 3 weeks ago. But that phone call was an important phone call, and there were elements of that phone call that have not been publicly reported and will not be publicly reported. But it was a legitimate reconciliation, and there was, I've been led to believe, there was a little bit of a, man, remember when going on there. Little nostalgia about, because LeBron's in a spot right now where, you know what type of player he could desperately use?
A Kyrie.
A guy like Kyrie Irving. And you know what Kyrie's learning in Boston? Yeah, having another veteran, having a guy that can really take on the full leadership mantle, which maybe Kyrie isn't quite cut out for, at least at this moment, the way he thought. And so we talk about the pending free agents this offseason, and we've just never included Kyrie as one of the Laker targets because of the way he and LeBron ended. I don't think people should dismiss this idea. I don't think right now it's the likely outcome, but it is not an impossible outcome. And I can tell you it's not one LeBron would stand in the way of. It's not one where LeBron would say, man, he left before. There was the odd interview after he left. That would not happen. And the Lakers, as we are seeing right now, have needs everywhere. Like, it's not like you can say, oh, well, he doesn't fit because we have Lonzo.
It
absolutely makes sense for the worst free throw shooting team in the league, one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the league, a team that really is struggling to score, to add one of the best and most unique scorers in the league.
I think LeBron ultimately realizes, too, regardless of what KD decides to do this offseason, he's going to have to be able to beat the Warriors. And in beating the Warriors, LeBron has a comfort level with only a certain number of players, Kyrie being one of those very few players. Now, there's players that he would like to take the court with, guys who aren't in Los Angeles, Kawhi and some other potential free agents, but what if they don't get them? I mean, what is the Lakers' plan B if Kawhi decides to go to the Clippers or do something else? Mm-hmm. What if they can't trade for AD? AD has already said, I'm not going to demand the trade, so that right there makes it problematic for the Lakers right there that he's not demanding a trade early, so that's going to take it to the summer. There's going to be other people trying to trade for AD. Boston's got more assets, draft picks, and or players that I think if I'm the Pelicans, that I would look to instead of looking to trade with the Lakers. So I think Magic Johnson and LeBron, they need more than one plan, and I do believe that Kyrie could be a part of those plans.
And how good would the Lakers be if these two team back up again? Because it seems like they've, I don't want to say given up on the young players, but they have definitely not played up to expectations.
Well, listen, we know how good a team can be with LeBron and Kyrie. They can win the championship. They can beat a 73-win Warrior team. They can be, when those two guys are both playing at peak capacity.
Do you think they can beat the Warriors?
Well, again, I don't know that anyone can beat this iteration of the Warriors. But to C's point, even if Kevin Durant leaves, the Warriors will still probably be the favorites out west. And so, yes, like the ability for them to add, they have to add another superstar for LeBron's year 17. Mm-hmm. The guys that are free agents, here's the list of. It's Klay. No one thinks he's leaving. And it would be wild to me if he left there to go to the Lakers. Durant, a lot of people think he's leaving, but not to go to the Lakers. Kawhi Leonard, who is going to Los Angeles, but there's two teams there. And Kyrie. That's the entire list. So if we're crossing off Klay, if we're crossing off KD, I think Kawhi will be their top target. But you can pursue both at the same time. I think people will hear this and dismiss it. I'm telling you right now, you should not dismiss this as a possibility.
All right, let's move on to the Dallas Cowboys, still in the news. That'll happen when your owner is still seemingly on the fence about your head coach. Jason Garrett has yet to receive an extension or a true endorsement from Jerry Jones. Now reports are circulating that the Cowboys might replace Jason Garrett with Saints head coach Sean Payton. Keep in mind, next season will be Garrett's last year of his deal. Chris, would the Cowboys be better off with Sean Payton than what you've seen with Jason Garrett?
I don't know. I don't know if Sean Payton can get it. One of the variables is how they get along with Jerry. Jerry's son, Stevens, is right-hand guy. So if someone can answer that, like I would be like, I don't like to do this type of speculation. All right? Trying to put one guy who's doing a great job and where do we get the indication Sean Payton's going to be available? Like, why would the Saints, Gail Benson, wife of the late Tom Benson, she's been running that team for a little more than a year. You think she's going to allow the best coach in franchise history just to walk out the door? Like, I don't think that's going to happen. And, excuse me, I don't think there's a person that knows if Sean Payton is a better fit with the Cowboys. There's a lot of distraction that go with the Cowboys. I think Sean Payton has done a marvelous job there in New Orleans. I think that him, Mickey Loomis, the general manager, Jeff Ireland, what they do from a front office standpoint as far as drafting players with Sean Payton in mind as far as coaching them, playing in that culture, I think Sean's done a great job. I don't think he's going to be available. So to think, everyone thinks they could do a better job than Jason Garrett because people don't respect him as a coach. I respect Jason Garrett as a coach. I know that's the toughest job in sports, to be the coach of the Dallas Cowboys. So my answer would be no initially, because I got a lot of respect for Jason Garrett and what he's doing.
I think you can have respect for what Jason Garrett's doing and still believe Sean Payton, if he were a coaching free agent, which he's not, and more on that in a moment, would be an upgrade. Like, I think Sean Payton is one of the very best coaches in the entire NFL. I think you could make the argument that the four best coaches in the league were the final four coaches that we had left in the playoffs this year to go along with the four best offenses, certainly four of the top five or six. And as far as his relationship ability to get along, we don't know how he would fit in the role of head coach of the Cowboys, but he was in Dallas before he went to New Orleans. He was the assistant head coach, the quarterback's coach there. So there is a relationship with Jerry Jones. At that point in time, Stephen Jones didn't have the role he has now, and Stephen Jones is more in charge of the day-to-day. But this is a weird instance because there just seems to be all of a sudden a lot of smoke surrounding this when contractually there would be no fire. Sean Payton is going into year four, so he has 2 years left, of a five-year, $45 million contract with the Saints.
So what would have to happen for him to be able to leave? He'd have to request.
Well, they would have to, the two organizations would have to come up with some type of agreement, either it be draft pick compensation or cash compensation or a collection of both, and Sean Payton would have to be down for it. There are a lot of reasons why, on its face, I believe, well, of course the Cowboys would want to get Sean Payton. Almost every team in the league would want to get Sean Payton. But for the same reasons you feel like the Saints would be hesitant to move on from Sean Payton, especially when the team, much like when we talked about Drew Brees yesterday and about his retirement window versus Brady's, why would Brees want to walk away now when they finally have the defense
together?
They're
that close.
Why would Sean Payton want to change things now when he feels, if they get that call right, we're going to the Super Bowl and we're the favorites in the Super Bowl. We're the best team in the league. But people close to the situation seem to think this is a real possibility, and it's been odd to me the way Jerry Jones has been. He's always been a backer of Jason Garrett. They just came off one of their best years. They won a playoff game, and he is yet to publicly commit to him. That part to me is there has to be a reason there.
So if we're going to compare the two coaches, let's look at year by year. How many losing seasons has Sean Payton had?
Well, he had three in a row, and he had one before that. So
Okay. I'll get back to that. How many has Jason Garrett had?
One losing season.
Oh, okay. So I'm just going to tell you, if Sean Payton was the coach in Dallas, he would have already been fired because he's already done something that Jason Garrett wouldn't do. He wouldn't have them three losing seasons. You think he would have survived those three losing seasons in Dallas with Jerry Jones as the owner?
No, but do you think he necessarily would have had losing seasons with the full team they had in Dallas? You understand what I'm saying?
I mean, where are they getting the players from? They're drafting from the same pool. They're putting a team out there. Yeah, Drew Brees had losing seasons.
Yep.
Dallas, you think Dallas is going to have a losing season when they had one of the marquee franchises? Like, so I just think that Sean Payton has done a good job in New Orleans. It hadn't been a job where he's been like, you know something? I'll take him over any coach in the league. He has had his own struggles. And if he had them same struggles in Dallas, that would have cost him his job. So how we look at Jason Garrett is totally different how we looked at Sean Payton.
I agree that Jason Garrett, when you look at his coaching resume, if you take his name out of it and you look at the win-loss record, there are a lot of things where you'd say this guy is the public view of him is very different than what his win-loss record should say. The fact that they only bottomed out the one season when Romo got hurt and they didn't have a backup, that they have been at least 8-8 or better seemingly every year. But the other reason why, if he were available, it would be very attractive to me is the Cowboys over the next 4 or 5 years are going to be determined – in large part by how good can Dak be? Because he's not going to be making $800,000 anymore. He's going to be getting a long-term extension, we all think, this offseason. And I don't know that there's a coach, there's not three coaches in the league, certainly, that I trust more to help Dak reach his full potential than Sean Payton. And if we think part of the problem with Dallas is the meddling of Jerry Jones.
Big part of the problem.
Okay, so Sean Payton would only, I would imagine, agree to come to the team.
If there was an understanding in place that he would have much more of an open pathway and much more say and veto power.
Similar to what Parcells had when he was there. Now, he wasn't there a long time for Parcells. I would argue the Parcells time did work while he was there. They had a really good season. There was the Romo fumbled snap that prevented them from winning that playoff game and moving on.
Yeah, but that's why you get a divorce. I mean, like, oh, how long were you married? 25 years. Well, shit was working while I was there. Yeah, you end up getting divorced because it didn't work. That's why Bill Parcells left. I know Bill Parcells. He's a very, very good friend of mine. And there's a number of things about Dallas that are not attractive. Sean Payton is Bill Parcells' number one guy.
Right.
That's like his son. I don't see Sean Payton. I don't see Bill Parcells giving Sean the advice. You should leave New Orleans. You should leave the Benson family and go partner with Jerry and Steven. See, I just don't see it happening. It's not the first time Sean Payton's been rumored to be going somewhere else, but I think people have forgotten Jason Garrett, one losing season. Sean Payton, three in a row with Drew Brees. Well, what if Jason Garrett had Drew Brees?
Yeah.
I think the conversation would be a little bit different.
All right, we got to take a break. Coming up, hey, how can the Rams defense slow down Tom Brady and the Patriots? That's next on First Things First. Here, First Things First, with Super Bowl champ Chris Kenny.
Good to see you.
In studio.
Good to see you too, bro.
Love having you here, Chris. All good?
All good, Jenna.
Awesome. Let's talk some Super Bowl. Despite many.
Good job. Yeah. High five, Jenna Wolf.
We had yet.
Did the Kenny intro? No problem. Seamless. Oh, no awkwardness. That was great,
Jenna Wolf. He almost terrified me.
You did great. Wow. Like watching the baby take her first steps.
People at home won't know.
Oh, they know, Jenna.
Okay.
That's the first time watching this show. They know.
No, I think that was more like a number two.
Sorry.
Thank you. Good girl. Good girl.
Anyway, let's move on to real words. Despite many calling this a down year for the Patriots, at least in the regular season, the team averaged 27 points per game, fourth most in the NFL. This postseason, they're averaging 39 points. Good luck defending against that. Unless you're Wade Phillips, even though this is the first trip to the Super Bowl for the majority of the Rams team, they have a calming force in Phillips, their D coordinator, who has won a Super Bowl. Bill Belichick spoke about Wade Phillips and the Rams' defense yesterday.
I don't think they're going to, you know, we're going to see like three new fronts and three new coverages in this game that he hasn't run in the last 30 years. I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen, but those will adjust to it. But they do what they do in their system. They do it well. They have a lot of confidence in it, which they should. He's been successful everywhere he's been. He's been doing it for 30 years in multiple organizations with multiple groups of players against, you know, every kind of offense he could see. So, yeah, I remember dealing it with him when I was in Cleveland. It's basically, you know, and to his credit, there's not many of us that have a system that can last that long. And, you know, I've certainly changed a lot in the last 30 years schematically. Wade really hasn't. I mean, he really hasn't.
All right, Chris Kenny, what do you think? What should the Patriots expect from Wade Phillips and that defense?
Well, I think they can expect that Wade Phillips is going to change it up a lot on Tom Brady. When you're playing against a quarterback that has that much experience and that has a reservoir of information, mm-hmm. you got to change up the looks on him. You can't remain static as a defense. Now, that's by the pre-snap disguises that they have, that secondary will try to confuse Tom Brady based on what they're trying to do, but also being able to change up the calls. When you look at that AFC Championship game going back to 2015 in Mile High Stadium, when Wade Phillips was the defensive coordinator for the Broncos, he did a lot of that changing it up on Tom Brady. They came out in that game in zone coverage. That was something that was unique for that Broncos defense just because they were so good in the secondary in that game.
Yeah, but that was the same thing they did to New Orleans last week. The first meeting during the season, they blitzed them, played man-to-man. New Orleans ran up and down the field on Micah Thomas, destroyed him. In this game, the NFC Championship game, they went back to that conventional defense that he played in Denver.
Absolutely. It was zone coverage. Then he came out with man free, straight man coverage. Then he went two man. So he just kept changing it up on Tom Brady. But in the first half, you had a lot of zone coverage. In the second half, they went back to a lot of straight man to man. Maybe a little bit of man free with one single high.
Yes.
But that's the thing that you have to do with Tom Brady. You have to continue to switch up the looks on him because he's got so many answers based on the defenses that you try to present to him. If you remain in the same look, he's going to pick you apart. So you have to switch it up on Tom Brady. That defense can't be static.
And that conference championship game that you're referencing is one of the worst playoff games of Tom Brady's career. He completed less than 50% of his passes, had more interceptions than touchdowns, had a quarterback rating sub 55. One of the playoff games that actually might be worse than that was a divisional round playoff game against the Chargers. That was another Wade Phillips defense in 2006. Like, that was a game where Brady had three interceptions to two touchdowns. They lost. They had that game lost on a Tom Brady interception until a guy we were talking about earlier, Troy Brown, forced a fumble, got the Patriots the ball back. They were able to come back and win. Wade has had some success against Brady in the playoffs. Now, he's obviously also taken some losses in the regular season and the playoffs, but the reason that I think this matchup is so interesting is because Wade had Bruce Smith, Wade had J.J. Watt, Wade now has Aaron Donald. If you give Wade Phillips, with what he likes to do, a dominant front four guy to go along with some legitimate corners, there's so many things he can do defensively and schematically. That's what he was never able to actually fully have in Houston. He had J.J., but he didn't have the two corners you could trust, that you could switch, that you could run different fronts and coverages with. I'm also curious to you, Canny, what you think he's going to do as far as Sue and Donald, where they line up, where they switch, if it was one time they're next to each other, one time one's on the end, one's on the guard, like how you think they're going to use those two players with Sue coming off the best two games he's played all year.
Well, I think a lot of it's going to depend on the down and distance, but I've played for Wade. I kind of understand how he thinks, how he likes to call a game. Mm-hmm. What he's going to do is try to present opportunities for his difference makers to be in one-on-one pass rush situations. Yeah. Now, you got to think that Bill Belichick will have some kind of plan to deal with Aaron Donald, double team him, try to do some things to make sure that Tom Brady has the opportunity to step up, because Tom Brady likes to operate from the well. He wants to stay in the pocket. Mm-hmm. But those other guys have got to come to the party. That's Dante Fowler Jr. That's Ndamukong Suh. They will have one-on-one opportunities, and Wade will scheme it up to make sure that those guys have one-on-one opportunities. It's just a matter of, will they be able to take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves?
What I expect from Wade is, and I'm going to go back to his Philadelphia days, and that's when he had Reggie White. And what I think he's going to do in this game is, I think he's going to play what the great Buddy Ryan coined as the 46 defense. And that's where you cover up the center and the two guards. The difference in this defense and Denver's defense, and why I don't think the Rams can be as successful as Denver was, Denver's, most of their pass rush, even though they had some very underrated defensive tackles, it came from the outside. Mm. So when you get outside pressure like that, it makes Brady, Belichick, that offense, it makes the tight end either stay in more, and or it makes the running backs chip or stay in. Man, the running backs are Tom Brady's second favorite thing to be able to throw to. So when you have defensive tackles, you can mush the line of scrimmage, have the guards and the tackles take those interior, so your backs can get out and you can get rid of the football. See, part of the attack to Aaron Donald is going to be, we're going to double team him by force, numbers. Other thing is, we're going to get the ball out of our hand. He's going to be single block, but we're going to get the ball out of our hand. So that's what I believe Wade is going to go to as far as a change of pace. He will go to that Kansas City game. Kansas City, at the end of that game, their defense was awful. It was totally predictable. Third and 10, what did they decide to do? They're going to go two-man every single time, and Tom Brady picked out that matchup on that slot receiver. Now, when they tried to change their coverage, when Gronk went outside of his normal traditional formation and went outside, Kansas City checked to cover one, and Tom Brady got him both times. Fade down the sideline over Eric Berry and set him up where he ran a slant later in the game. So Wade will learn from that, and Wade has had some success, so I expect him to have a variety of three or four coverages at the end of the game that he can go to try to have success.
Nick, you said a segment, two segments ago, that Tom Brady is as precise and as smart a quarterback as there is in the league. Probably the smartest quarterback Wade is going to defend against just this season. How hard is it to confuse a guy like that?
Well, I think it has to be at the last second, right? It's got to be that you show him one thing, he sees it, they maybe check out of the play, they do whatever it is, and then you switch it late. Like, I feel like that's the only way to even temporarily confuse him.
I think people need to remove confusion from your dictionary.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get in the game. If I'm playing this game, there's no coverage you can give me that's going to confuse me. The thing is, you want to shorten the time they have to react. That's what coverage is about. I want to show them something else. And when he goes under center, and when he starts to focus to get the football, then I want to give him the illusion of if it's something else. Now, unless you physically feel like you're better than them. Von Miller was absolutely just physically better than them. Aaron Donald is better than them. They're not going to allow it to get to a physical strength battle or skill battle. They're going to help them with numbers. So it's about giving them less time to be able to carve you apart. That's where we should be conversating on. You're not going to confuse any of these. Jared Goff is not going to be confused. Now, can you take away his time to be able to adapt? Now, he hasn't seen what Brady's seen, so he will be a little more alarmed when he sees certain things. But Tom Brady, you just want to take away that time from him, can't
you? No, you're absolutely right, CC. And the other part about this, what Wade Phillips ultimately wants to do, it's going to depend on those corners being able to hold up, whether or not the game plan is going to be effective. Yes. Because ultimately, whether you're in zone coverage or man coverage, at a certain point in the down, it becomes man coverage. And can those guys on the outside hold up against those Patriots receivers, let those interior defenders being able to match up against those routes that they like to run in between the numbers?
All right, Chris, stick around. Got to take a break. Coming up, how are the Pats receivers always so productive? That's next on First Things First. Here with Chris Candy, we are going viral. Patrick Mahomes is the presumed MVP this season, but with the Chiefs getting eliminated from the AFC Championship, Mahomes has time to work on his offseason craft. Hitting absolute bombs at a driving range. Not surprisingly.
With his guy, Garrett Dieter, the receiver on the Chiefs, like the sixth receiver.
It's
the person. Garrett Dieter. The person beneath him, on the level beneath him, is hitting bombs as well that are a lot straighter than Mahomes if you see him when his drives come through. Right there, you saw it for a moment. Look at Patty Mahomes. Man, these guys is not. Canny, you golf?
Yeah, I do golf. But why? It sounds like you're hating on Pat Mahomes because he's not hitting the drive straight. Or not as straight as the guy beneath him. Sounds like a little shade.
There's a lot of things I do on this television show. Hate on one, Patrick Mahomes the second is not one of them.
Well, that was a little sideways.
No, I'm just saying I'm curious who the fella beneath him was.
He's hitting drives that are more straight than Patrick Mahomes.
The fella beneath him seemed to be doing
it. It ain't about the fella beneath him. It's about Pat Mahomes.
All right, Canny.
Okay.
Well, damn.
That's what I'm saying.
Welcome to the show.
Great replacement for me. Slide on over here.
What's happening?
I like
just my commentary. You have your own commentary.
Let's see you go out there and do better than that.
Okay. Oh, now
I told you you're not good at them highlights.
I want to fight.
I told you you ain't good at them highlights, man.
Back to the Patriots now. The storyline.
Stick to your numbers, buddy.
With this team has been the rotating cast of wide receivers that have come in and out of New England. Since returning to week five, Julian Edelman has been a constant. The folks over at Pro Football Focus have ranked Edelman the number one receiver this postseason. He has 247 yards on 16 catches and a postseason best 14 catches on first downs. Chris Kenny, how are the Patriots wide receivers always able to succeed with so much turnover at that position?
Well, I think it starts with Bill Belichick, the general manager, and being able to find smart football players. And CC, you alluded to a little bit of this earlier about how you have to be a smart football player, especially in that attack position for the Patriots in their offense, that slot position, the ball is going to go there. And a lot of how Tom Brady is going to execute in terms of being able to get that receiver the ball depends on the looks that the defense presents. And so that slot receiver has to be on the same page with Tom Brady. Now, the other part of it, which probably won't get talked about a whole lot, is the Patriots' ability to be able to protect Tom Brady.
Oh my God!
That's the basics and the essence of what they're trying to do offensively with their passing attack. Because Tom Brady is not a mobile quarterback. You have to make sure that you have a clean pocket for him to be able to step up and throw the ball. The Patriots like throwing the ball in between the numbers in the middle of the field. Your quarterback has to be able to step up and has to have a clear window to be able to deliver those passes. And so if you look at what the Patriots have done in the postseason, they haven't allowed Tom Brady to be sacked in the two games that they played so far. And during the course of the regular season, they allowed the least amount of edge pressure of any team in the National Football League. I think the pressure rate is right around 10%. So, I mean, that tells you the job that their offensive line coach, Dante Scarnecchia, has been able to do with that group. A lot of question marks about how they were going to replace the loss of Nate Solder in free agency. Yep. Trent Brown has stepped right in. They haven't missed a beat. So a lot of their success in the passing game and what these wide receivers have been able to do from a productivity standpoint starts with the offensive line being able to protect.
And speaking of the loss of Nate Solder and Trent Brown stepping in, that wasn't their initial plan. Their first pick of this draft was not Sony Michel. It was a left tackle who popped his Achilles in preseason.
Isaiah Wynn.
And so because of that, now whether Wynn was going to play left tackle or right tackle, I'm not certain. But they were clearly their initial plan. They had to go to a plan B, and they still have been able to keep Tom Brady upright, particularly this postseason when he's been sacked zero times. He's only even been hit three times. But the other reason why the Patriots have been able to go from Troy Brown to Wes Welker to Julian Edelman with a little Danny Amendola mixed in is just like we talk about the Pats being able to reinvent themselves, the style of team they are, they recognize how rule changes affect football as well as any team in the league. When Chris was playing, a guy Wes Welker or Julian Edelman's size would have a lot more trouble being that effective in that role because you could hit guys differently. When all of a sudden, oh, wait, we don't have to, you have to be tough, but the ability for us to repeatedly go over the middle, and it's not going to get you killed. You're not going to be knocked out of the game because guys can't hit you in the head anymore. They took advantage of that as well as anybody. But with respect to Julian Edelman, to me, this is plug and play. This is a guy that there was a guy before Julian Edelman named Wes Welker who was actually a little bit better. There's a guy in Troy Brown who was very similar, and there will be a guy after.
Yeah, and Troy Brown was better than them.
Absolutely. Troy Brown's didn't have the numbers those other guys had because they didn't throw the ball to the level they do now. But there'll be a guy, if Julian Edelman, we saw it last year, by the way, he missed the year with an injury. The first four games this year, he was suspended. And if he were to go somewhere else next season, if Julian Edelman were to take the Cole Beasley route of, I am not respected enough, I need to, guess what? Cole Beasley could come into this team if Julian Edelman left, right? Like, yeah, absolutely.
No doubt.
And I'm not, and so that is, it is what the Patriots system is built on. And you got to be smart, you got to be tough, and you got to have good hands. But Brady and McDaniels will do the rest almost.
With regards to Julian Edelman, Jerry Rice was asked what Edelman's biggest asset, and he said, oh, it's easy. It's the chip that he carries on his shoulder all the time. And we talked about this week, that he's always sort of played angry a little bit. And I wonder how much of being a little undersized has also helped in that position within the Patriots system.
I mean, he does play with a great deal of intensity. He's a very smart player. I could understand what Jerry would say about that as far as having that type of attitude and how he would respect that. But to me, if you can't get separation at the top of the route, if you don't know what you're supposed to be doing, if you can't play all five receiver positions, that's his number one asset, is his brain. Played quarterback in college at Kent State. Now he's converting over being a wide receiver. His ability to be able to separate in them little short areas, be sure-handed, be physically tough, have that chip on his shoulder. Because when I'm running the route, I ain't got no chip on my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
I got my technique and I got my brain. So for me, those are the number one attributes in him being very successful. And Nick wasn't trying to hate on him. He's just saying it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are products of the system. And I would argue that New England receivers, they're not efficient. They're not very good. That's why 33 of them have come through the door in New England since the spring. Philip Dorsett is a former first-round pick. You think they're satisfied with Hogan, what he's done since he came over from free agency? No, that's why they keep bringing all these other people. Josh Gordon, they went out and traded for him. So I would argue everyone but Edelman has been totally inefficient, and New England in the last 5 years, newsflash, their number one wide receiver is Gronk. So they're products of that system. They're going to plug someone else in if Edelman is not there. So they have gotten everything from the talent at the position, but they're one of the least talented wide receiving groups of the 32 teams in the NFL.
No, and you're bringing up a great point, CC, but one thing that Julian Edelman does know and the rest of those guys on that Patriots team know is that if you don't do your job, Bill Belichick will replace you. So when you're running those routes, especially in the middle of the field, there's going to be some contact. That goes without saying. Those guys, they don't have the luxury of being able to make a business decision. They have to go in there and they have to catch that pass and know that they're going to take a big shot. But that's a part of the culture that Bill Belichick has been able to build in New England. You don't see that everywhere else. So you might not have a player that's the most talented, but that guy knows that he has to go in there and take that big shot because that's a part of him being in that role, and that's a part of why he's employed by the Patriots.
New England receivers have a luxury that very few other groups of wide receivers have. The ball is only coming to them when they have a great matchup. You won't see the ball coming to them when it's a bad matchup. And I watched film. I watched all 22. Those guys aren't open. So Tom Brady's not throwing to them. So we don't even see film of them being covered, which they're covered a lot. Tom Brady gets the best matchup. So every time you see a New England wide receiver, all you're seeing them is at their very best because Tom Brady has selected them and he selected that matchup based on what he knows about that defender.
And because of his precision and accuracy, he's so rarely putting his guys in a bad spot. When you go over the middle that often, if you have an erratic quarterback that's going to lead you into a big hit that the ball's not going to speak to you on, it is hard to be as productive and, aside from the ACL, as healthy as Edelman has been, as productive or as healthy as Wes Welker were, because they are undersized. They are more susceptible to getting walloped. But Brady, if you need to be catching the ball going low, he's going to throw it to you low. If you have open space, he's going to throw it out in front of you. Like, I think Edelman is really, really good at this specific role, but we have enough history to tell us if Brady keeps playing, they will find another guy who can be really, really good at this specific role.
All right, Chris Cannon, we'll see you a little bit later on in the show. Coming up, it's a time for the Saints to just move on from that blown call in the NFC Championship game. That's next. First things first. Tomorrow, it is a welterweight title fight as undefeated Keith Thurman defends his belt against Jose Zito Lopez live from Barclays Center tomorrow at 8 Eastern, only on Fox and the Fox Sports app.
I'll be out there.
Cannot wait. We'll get the Saints players still complaining in a second, but first, Thunder, Pelicans, Abdel Nader driving baseline dunks all over Cheick Diallo.
I can't believe he got up for a two-hander here. It looked like he was rising up for a one-hand slam. To be able to throw this down with two hands. Just see Cheick Diallo was like, should I contest? Should I go for the charge? He was stuck in the middle, ends up getting boomed on.
Same decision I had to make last night. Man, do I go with one or two for the layup?
Oh, the layup. Okay. All right. I was waiting. I was like, how much lies are about to be told here?
More NBA Warriors in D.C. Oh. Steph Curry with some fancy moves before hitting the shot over Otto Porter.
Steph did this exact same thing from this exact spot on the court, on the other end of the court in the first half, where he's just mixing a guy up, a little mid-range. Oh, mid-range is dead? Well, not when you're Steph Curry. Oh, eat that. Give me a foot of separation. Nothing but the bottom of the net. Steph 38 last night, I think. Maybe a little closer game than the Warriors would have liked. Great game by him.
All right, finally, college basketball, UCLA versus Arizona State. This is Jalen Hands taking off, rocking the rim.
I'm telling you, this was the nicest dunk of the season. I mean, and that's in poly, Nick.
I know.
Look at that.
It
sideways.
Brings up a little nostalgia, doesn't it? Sitting. You and
oh,
me,
yeah, man. I used
feet
to
on the wood.
Oh, man. Watching
catching
UCLA.
Lonzo.
More so playing at the John Wooden gym. I love that. I miss L.A., man.
I just miss going to those games, man. Beautiful campus. Ah, such yep. is life. I'll go to St. John's this week and check it out. It's just the same.
Yeah.
We good? We're back from
no
memory
problem.
Lane.
Sorry.
Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks.
On to the now famous missed call in the NFC Championship game. Not surprisingly, the Saints are still not over it. That grudge led by tight end Benjamin Watson, who took to Twitter yesterday and had some strong words for Roger Goodell. Watson tweeted, quote, "Your continued silence on this matter is becoming of the position you hold. Lead by example. We are waiting." CC, is it time for the Saints to move on from this missed call?
They got no choice. I mean, what are they going to do? I mean, the last couple years, what's happened to them? The Minneapolis Miracle, where they lose on a Hail Mary to a deep out. Their safety is there before the play, decides, I don't want to be pass interference, and they lose that game, prevent them from going to the NFC Championship in Philadelphia. Philly ends up winning the Super Bowl. And then this year, a blatant pass interference at home, critical point in the game. Was it the biggest call in the game? Yes, absolutely it was the biggest call. And I believe because Sean Payton and what happened, I believe it affected him what he did afterwards. Because I still believe mentally he was still on that play, trying to get the referee's attention, trying to get them to look. So I believe emotionally he hadn't moved on from it. I believe it affected him what they did after that.
In overtime, you're talking about the play calling in overtime?
Yeah, absolutely. Every play from that play, gotcha, I believe, was affected, and he would not let it go. As a team, as an organization, what do they gain? What do you gain? Would you want some announcement by Roger today? What is that going to help?
So that's my question. What do they want Roger Goodell to do? So apologize and acknowledge that it happened? No, no, no. It's been acknowledged.
Okay, but it hasn't officially been acknowledged by the league. That's what he's talking about. Ben Watson wants the league to come out and say we blew the call.
But now, they had the referees already, right? Didn't he call the league office after the game?
So they want what's similar to what happened. If you guys remember, there's another playoff game decided by a blown pass interference call. Giants 49ers. Everyone talks about the bad snap. This was back in 2002. You remember that? There's a bad snap by the Giants long snapper. Poor guy got pulled out of retirement 4 days before the game because they wanted him to be the long snapper. And then he has this huge gaffe. And it's a bad snap. They throw the ball deep downfield. The guy gets tackled. And the league next day said, yeah, it should have been pass interference. You should have gotten another chance at field goal. Our bad. My guess is the reason the league hasn't said anything is because this has gotten to weird places. You've got members of the U.S. House of Representatives from Louisiana saying, we want to call Goodell in to testify. You have people threatening to sue. I'm sure there's lawyers saying we shouldn't say anything right now. But enough. Like, listen, what happened here is the referee had a 1 in 100 awful moment. This is no different than, it to me, Minnesota Vikings fans wanting to sue Blair Walsh when he had a 1 in 100 awful moment, missing a 26-yard field goal to win a playoff game. This happens. I feel terribly for the Saints that it happened. It didn't, in my opinion, decide the game in this way. They had opportunities after that.
It wasn't the last play of the game.
Okay, so it wasn't the last play of the game. No. They could have stopped them on defense in regulation. They didn't. They won the coin toss in overtime. They could have not thrown an interception to start overtime. They had opportunities. And I obviously had issue with their play calling on first down on that drive, but set that aside. This happens, man. I feel badly for the people of New Orleans. Drew Brees, it's a legacy changer. I get all that. But with human beings and pro sports, guys are going to screw up. And I don't understand why we hold the referees to a standard of you cannot make an egregious mistake when we are watching football players who every week there's someone that makes an egregious mistake. We're not saying that, no, maybe it's because those guys can be cut and the referees we feel like don't get penalized. I'm not certain, but this happens. It'll happen probably again in 10 or 15 years.
It happens. From a conversation standpoint, as far as what the league did, why they didn't make a formal announcement, I don't know that. But they did go through a process of this. What happens on the field, Sean Payton talked to the league office on Sunday. He talked to the league office before his press conference after the game. So he had mentioned that. Roger and Sean Payton, I know for a fact that they talked on Tuesday. So they personally, Roger Goodell and Sean Payton, did have a conversation. People are wondering, well, why doesn't Roger release something afterward? I don't know that. But I do know the typical communication happens on game day. That happened with the league office on game day with Sean Payton, and he talked to the commissioner. So I don't believe that you're going to get all the calls right. So there are calls more critical because of the time. You don't have time to recover from them because they're later in the game. I don't know what else the league can do besides admitting the ref missed a call. We knew that. I knew he didn't do it on purpose.
Right.
But the way the ball was thrown, the route of the running back, the defender being lost in coverage, being in the wrong defense, making a beeline for a guy who he didn't cover, all those things added up to a guy missed it. He was a little bit late on it. I believe they were in position to make the call, but by the way the ball was flighted, the contact of the wide receiver, he thought simultaneously they got there at the same time. But We have all these different angles. We can slow it down. Of course we're going to get it right. But I could understand why he would miss that in real time.
I think even by missed call standards, this is an extreme one. This is a really bad one. And it's obviously an extreme one given, oh, we're inside 2 minutes of a tied NFC championship game. But in the AFC championship game, and I have not raised this complaint one time. There was a horrendous call made as far as a roughing the passer on Brady that did not exist, that hurt the Chiefs' ability to win that game. And then the Patriots fans would say there was a horrendous missed call on an obvious 8-yard down the field pick on the Sammy Watkins touchdown that it looked like the Chiefs might have scored the game-winning touchdown on. There isn't a perfect way to officiate professional football. Now, could the NFL be better? Are there adjustments they should make? Are there things, should we maybe have a discussion about, is there an ideal age and fitness for referees that have to run up and down the field? Like, are there things that we should look at? Absolutely. Ain't none of that putting the Saints in the Super Bowl. None of it. No statement from Goodell, no congressional inquiry.
Right.
And I just, it is odd to me that we are at Friday. Ben Watson, one of the smartest, most respected players in the league, he's putting that out on Twitter as if that will make things better. There's not one Saints fan in America that's like, okay, Goodell admitted they blew it. Now I feel better about this.
I just don't understand what they could do, what the commissioner's office could do, say, put out there that would appease.
Make them go restart it, do over. Saints ball first and goal inside the 4 with a minute 40 left. Like, come on, that ain't happening.
All right, take a break. Coming up, can Aaron Donald and the Rams defense slow down Tom Brady? Next on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, we are going viral. Luka Doncic is well on his way to Rookie of the Year honors, but before he was on everyone's radar, he was training with the best of the best with leaked footage of Doncic and Steph Curry training together back in August.
Oh, maybe this is where Doncic developed that step back from Steph. I like this now.
Oh, I always like the younger players working out with the veterans. There's so much information that they can get. This is stuff the coaches can't teach you. Man, NBA players, NFL players, Major League Baseball, if a guy has done it, oh, man, he's capable of teaching you how to do it. Love it.
And one of the reasons Doncic came into the league so polished is he's been working out with pros, maybe not at Steph Curry level, but pros since he was 14 years old, been playing against them since he was 15 years old, which is why he can come on and instantly be, as a teenager, one of the 35 best players in the league already. He's been awesome.
Oh, Nick's list, 35 best players in the NBA.
You want the 34 out of it?
Yeah, we're good.
Why not 34?
What? Because he's 30. What do you mean?
Because in his head he's 35,
why not?
See?
I actually think he's probably 31 or 32, but I could be leaving someone else. So I gave myself a little wiggle room.
Someone at 35
best.
Top 30.
Because I don't think he is.
Top 37 and a half dudes I ever met.
You know what? Just because I'm into precision and accuracy, I shouldn't be laughed at.
Thank God it's Friday.
Friday. You ain't lying.
Time for stories. Your AT&T wake-up call.
I'm writing them down.
Sticking with the NBA, where starters for the All-Star game were announced. And in the West, it'll be LeBron, KD, Paul George, Harden, and Steph Curry. In the East, it's Giannis, Kawhi, Embiid, Kyrie, and Kemba Walker. Nick, did the fans get the starters right?
9 out of 10. I would have included Anthony Davis at the expense of Kevin Durant. Now, obviously, Anthony Davis is going to be an All-Star, and in my world, Durant would have been an All-Star. I don't look at All-Star team the way I look at MVP, where how good your team is has a lot to do with whether or not you're an All-Star. To me, it's an individual award based on your individual performance, not a valuable proposition that has to do with team winning, so I would have had AD on
And
there.
You probably prefer a conventional lineup.
Yeah, you know, it's nice to have a real center. You have Embiid on one side.
I mean,
sure.
We only have a few centers. When you start eliminating that, you're going to miss someone. KD, them being the best team in the NBA, two-time MVP, I think that they should have two starters, him and Steph. So it's hard. It's a good problem to have. Mm-hmm. AD has been outstanding, though, on a team that hadn't been very good.
Last week, we learned that Kyrie Irving reached out to his former teammate LeBron James. Now Kevin Love is suggesting that Kyrie could potentially reunite with LeBron in L.A. Nick, could Kyrie team up again with LeBron this summer?
I would not say it's the likely outcome, but it is not an impossible outcome the way it would have been a month ago, and it is something that I think people should add to the list of possibilities for Lakers offseason targets.
So you're sensing from that conversation, maybe some things came out of that that aren't out there publicly? That's what you're reading?
Correct. That is that. I know there are things that have not been reported and won't be reported about a level of reconciliation between the two that would make this an actual possibility if Kyrie wants to leave Boston, if the Lakers don't get Kawhi. There are a lot of ifs that would have to fall into place, but a month ago, this was impossible.
Right.
It's no longer impossible.
Oh, I know. You're going to tell me that information because I know you'll snitch.
I'll squeal.
That. I know
I'll
you
squeal.
Will. Snitches get stitches.
Yesterday, it was reported that Cam Newton had an arthroscopic procedure on his right shoulder. This is the second shoulder surgery in 3 years for Cam Newton. He had surgery to fix a partially torn rotator cuff back in March of 2017. See, what do you make of this?
I'm glad he's able to get it done. I'm glad that, you know, from the time they put him on the shelf, the last couple weeks of the regular season, between then and now, he's rehabbed it. Obviously, they feel that the rehab is not going to be significant enough that they must do a procedure. This is something like Andrew Luck. He thought he didn't need a procedure, tried to rehab it, then ultimately put it off where then they had to go in and correct it. So I'm glad early in the offseason you can get it done to get him back healthy. The NFL is better when Cam Newton is healthy, playing his best football.
And I fully agree with that last part. And also, I'm glad it's arthroscopic surgery. It's not some major surgery where we're talking about a multi-month timeline. This is more of, the way I understand it from reading the local reports, what they think is it's more of a tweak and an adjustment than some type of reconstruction. What are you laughing about?
I was getting ready to trick you and tell you the arthroscopic.
No, you can't trick me. I've had that. I've had arthroscopic surgery on my shoulder. See? You can't trick me on that.
Now you got something in common with Cam Newton.
Okay. Oh, and our fashion sense, sir.
Ending with the Antonio Brown saga, the all-pro wideout at the center of trade rumors after a rocky ending with the Steelers. And Brown took to Twitter to weigh in, simply tweeting, "Open for business." CeCe, which team should try to deal for Antonio Brown this offseason?
All right, I got it, Nick. I was just messing around earlier in the show. I really got it. I was trying to send in to Tom Coughlin, you know, a little correction. My son, about 7th, 8th grade, I was like, listen, son, if you don't get your act together, I'll send you to military school. That's what I'll do. I don't send him that little camp in the summertime, other people 6 weeks up in the mountains, all that, playing with the bus. No,
yeah.
I'm not going to send him to Jacksonville.
Okay, because that would be, that's the NFL military school.
But they do need a number one receiver. They can run the ball. Put him in Florida with those personalities on that defense. I do believe that can work. But the best spot for him, Cleveland Browns. Go get him.
Oh, I like that idea.
Go to Cleveland with Baker Mayfield, and, man, they would make some things happen. They need an outside number one guy. Jarvis Landry's been recruiting everyone in the NFL. He's been sending on Twitter,
Instagram.
Trying
to get Odell everywhere.
Go Cleveland. Cleveland needs another wide receiver. With the way they ran that ball with Kitchens, Baker Mayfield, that defense is underrated, and you get them Steelers twice a year. Now, that would be good for business.
And so I know some people would say you don't trade within your division.
Right,
we've had this discussion before. I think you make the best trade possible. I think that you can't worry about, am I making this other team better? You have to say, what is the best return I can get? Which is why my initial reaction is, if I'm Pittsburgh, I call up San Francisco and I make them have a meeting about the number two pick of the draft for Antonio Brown. Straight up. No multiple picks.
Yeah, that
no
ain't going to happen. That short conversation.
San Francisco says no.
Goodbye.
No, no. I took a lot of hits to the head, but not that many. Goodbye.
Okay, so you think that's giving up too much?
No, if you give me the top pick or that second pick in the second round, you can have him.
See, so I'm very curious to see if he gets moved, what his actual value is, because Antonio Brown, with his talent level and his contract, which is going to be a great contract.
I don't think the contract is going to help him. It looks like a good contract on paper, but when you make that transaction, Antonio, you know who his agent is?
Was it Tom Condon?
What about Drew Rosenhaus?
Rosenhaus.
Oh, okay. So the only way they can make money is by renegotiating an extension. So in that contract, you're getting a 30-year-old receiver who's walked out on the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he's going to want a new contract. No guy's getting traded saying, no, I'll come there under this current agreement.
Right.
So that right there keeps the price down. That's why he's going to be a second rounder.
All right, we haven't prepped this yet. I'm right now Kevin Colbert. You're John Lynch. I'm going to call you and make the offer. Hey, we'll send you AB for the number two pick. What do you say?
No.
Okay, how about this? We'll send you AB if we can swap picks. We get the number two, you get the 20th. So you're staying in the first round, you're dropping back 18 spots, and you're getting Antonio Brown. Does that entice you?
You got to give me a little sweetener. I like a little sweetener in my coffee. I need a little something.
All right,
I probably need another third.
A third? I can't give you a third. I can give you a fifth. I can give you the 20th.
Give me a fourth. If you move me back down and give me a fourth, I would take it. I get two players.
You guys know this is a fake conversation, right?
Yeah, but okay. John Lynch.
No, that's the thing. I almost tweeted it. Listen. I was like, big news just happened. Did you hear about the trade?
I saw John Lynch go from working for Fox on television to the GM booth with 6 years guaranteed.
Anything can happen.
Yeah, I'm just putting it out there. I feel like it was good negotiation. Good talking to you. We'll call back. I'm calling.
We should do more of those. It should be a segment called
Role Play.
Fake trade.
That's a weekend segment, Jenna.
Oh, Nick. Oh, Dusty liked that one. Back to the Super Bowl. The Patriots offense has been hot this postseason.
Friday's always a good day to get fired.
We don't usually get that from you.
You never get it from me.
I was a little bit surprised.
I know.
Impressed.
You got plenty of heathen off in you.
Go ahead, Jenna.
Patriots are averaging 39 points this
postseason.
He's
no choir boy. At 5'9", he raised a lot of hell.
All right, Jenna, please keep talking.
Good luck defending against that Patriots offense unless you are one Wade Phillips, even though this is the first trip to the Super Bowl for the majority of the Rams team. They have a calming force in Wade Phillips, their D coordinator, who has won a Super Bowl. Bill Belichick spoke about Wade and the Rams defense yesterday.
I don't think they're going to, you know, we're going to see like three new fronts and three new coverages in this game that he hasn't run in the last 30 years. I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen, but if it does, we'll adjust to it. But that's, they do what they do in their system. They do it well. They have a lot of confidence in it, which they should. He's been successful everywhere he's been. He's been doing it for 30 years in multiple organizations with multiple groups of players against every kind of offense he could see. So, yeah, I remember dealing it with him when I was in Cleveland. It's basically, you know, and to his credit, there's not many of us that have a system that can last that long. And, you know, I've certainly changed a lot in the last 30 years schematically. Wade really hasn't. I mean, he really hasn't.
All right, Cece, what should the Patriots expect from Wade Phillips and that defense?
I think it's difficult for Wade. The last time he was in a matchup like this, he had a Denver Broncos team, very, very similar as far as the corners. Actually, one of the corners is still the same in Tlaib. But most of his pressure that he could get was from the outside in Von Miller. And that's what New England feared. And then in doing that, we know Tom Brady likes to step up. So if you have outside pressure, typically it becomes harder on the offense because you either have to have a tight end stay in and help chip block and or a running back. Man, those are two of Tom Brady's favorite targets, how they want to run their offense. So I believe with the interior pressure that the Rams present, that I believe that Tom Brady, he's on single block suing them more than you think because he can get the ball out to his tight end or the running back to alleviate the pressure. So I think Wade should go back to an old 46, Buddy Ryan type defense. He played that defense in Philadelphia with Reggie White where you cover up the center and the two guards. Let them tackle stay on an island because if you do that, each one of those guys is single block. New England interior, center, and their two guards, I would say the best interior offensive line in the NFL in 2018. But you make them single block compared to combination blocks, which they love to do, 90 dropbacks in the playoffs, not sacked one time because that great interior pressure. So if I'm Wade, I'm lining up in some bare fronts, Buddy Ryan style. I'm covering up all three of those guys because that is the strength of that offensive line, not allowing them to double team Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald.
90 dropbacks, no sacks against Melvin Ingram, Joey Bosa, Chris Jones, Justin Houston, D Ford. Only hit three times. In the Chiefs game, the Patriots ran 94 plays, pardon me. They had one negative play. It was the kneel down at the end of the regulation. Their ability to keep not only Brady upright, but prevent any penetration on running plays was spectacular. I have a question, though, about this 46 defense, C. You just mentioned the things it allows you to do. Anything that has some advantages has to have some drawbacks. What are the downsides? What's the potential reason he wouldn't play a 46, like you're saying?
His linebackers could be exploited. Linebackers have to play man-to-man, and you identify one high safety. He knows you're they're going to be in man-to-man. I like the matchups on the outside of the corners, being able to lock down the wide receivers. That's the reason why I like a 46. One of the plus minuses, one of the linebackers is going to be blitzing in that 46. So you take him out of coverage. So there's a big plus there, and there are a few minuses. That's why a lot of teams don't play 46 defense on the regular in the NFL.
So I think the audience might know this. Like, listen, I'm partial to Wade. I know Wade. Wade and I used to do radio together when I was in Houston, and I think Wade somehow has gotten a bad rap about what a good coach he's been at every stop, including a head coach. This guy's 82-64 as a head coach, 562 winning percentage, went to the playoffs 5 of his 8 years he was a full-time head coach, only had one losing season as a full-time head coach.
Only reason why he wasn't successful as a head coach, he didn't have postseason success, and Wade is not going to win the press conference.
No.
He is not going to be. We think he's funny as players and other coaches and those who get to know him. But a lot of times when you have that type of coach, he doesn't win those press conferences. People take away from his football IQ for some reason just because he's not demanding. He is not that kind of speaker on a daily, weekly basis.
And the way he sounds, people judge him and think he's not bright. And he's incredibly bright. It's just not fair. It's just whether it's his drawl or the way he kind of carries himself. And by the way, the lack of playoff success, I mean, he was the victim of the Music City Miracle.
Yes.
Like, you know, I mean, that Bills team was a good team. So I say that about Wade because he also, though, has, if we are listing Pantheon defensive linemen of the last 30 years, how many of them have been coached by Wade Phillips? Reggie White is maybe at the top of the list.
Yes.
Bruce Smith might be second on the list. Mm-hmm. J.J. Watt in the more modern era, and now Aaron Donald. All four of those guys Wade has had. The reason I think he can have more success with this Rams team against Tom Brady, Jenna, than he had when he was the D coordinator for the Texans and they got lit up by Tom Brady is he didn't have the corners. In Houston, Jonathan Joseph was a good corner. They couldn't find the complement to him. Mm-hmm. And to have Tlaib and Peters, who we've now seen them both healthy, what they can do with a motivated Ndamukong Suh, and we know how good Aaron Donald is, if that linebacking core can just hold up, I think Wade can do some things now. I think this defense can present real problems for a Patriots team that just annihilated the Chargers in the first half, won the game there, and hung 37 on a Chiefs team that hadn't given up 30 at home in 4 years. So I think Wade is well positioned for this matchup, assuming the weakness of the team, that linebacking core, can hold up just a bit.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up is Sean Payton heading to the Cowboys. That's next on First Things First. Back here with Super Bowl champ Chris Caney. We're talking about one of his old teams, the Cowboys. Jason Garrett, the head coach, has yet to receive an extension or a true endorsement from Jerry Jones. Now reports are circulating that the Cowboys might replace Garrett with Saints head coach Sean Payton. Keep in mind, next season will be Garrett's last year of his deal. Canny, both of these guys coached the Cowboys while you were there. Would Dallas be better served with Sean Payton at the helm over Jason Garrett?
Well, I think Sean Payton's a better coach, so the obvious answer is yes. Now, I don't know if this situation is going to happen. Now, Sean is very fond of the Cowboys organization. He was the assistant head coach when Bill Parcells was the big guy down there making all the decisions. And so Sean is very familiar with the organization, and I believe there's mutual respect from that Jones family towards Sean Payton and the kind of coach that he's developed into. That being said, I know Sean Payton signed a contract extension with the New Orleans Saints a couple of years ago. I don't think they would be in a hurry to let him go, especially with the young core of players that they've been able to develop. Now, Drew Brees, we don't know how long he's going to play, but, I mean, you got to think that Sean Payton has a pretty good situation down there in New Orleans. So I don't know if this marriage is actually going to take place, but I know there's been a lot of posturing back and forth. And there's the old cliche that you're only as loyal as your options. Now, that's both for the Cowboys and for Sean Payton. I know that there have been scouts and people close to Sean Payton that said that is a job that he would love to have. It's an iconic franchise, and, of course, everybody knows the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys, so I know that is factoring in there. But I don't foresee Sean Payton leaving New Orleans to go join the Dallas Cowboys and be their head coach.
Listen, I think with 2 years, $18 million left on his deal with New Orleans, because he signed a 5-year, $45 million deal before the 2016 season, I think this is unlikely that New Orleans would make him available. By the way, if they wanted to trade picks for him, the Cowboys, keep in mind, don't even have their first-round pick this year. There would be some type of cash compensation. But I also think that the only reason Jerry Jones has not publicly committed to Jason Garrett and given Jason Garrett a contract extension going into the final year of his deal, which is when coaches get their extensions, you almost never have a lame duck coach in the NFL, is because he thinks it's possible. Is because he thinks that this is, he doesn't want to slam the door shut on this before he knows that it absolutely can't happen. Because even if you believe Jason Garrett is underrated, underappreciated as a head coach, I don't know that anybody thinks he's a better coach than Sean Payton. And if the future of the Cowboys is going to be dictated so much by the progression of Dak Prescott, especially once he gets 5 years, $125 million, I would rather that be Sean Payton leading that progression than Jason Garrett. But there are a lot of moving parts here. It's just odd to me that after everyone got a sign of endorsement from Jerry Jones, the quarterback, the wide receiver, the running back, Jason Garrett helped this team rally from 3-5 to a playoff win, that he's the one guy, when Jerry's always been loyal to him, that Jerry won't go on his radio show, and when he's asked about him, he's like, ah.
Because he was asked.
He was asked about him. 105.3 in Dallas. And he was like, I have no, there's no reason for me to make some statement about that right now. When he said, when things could open up, like, what does that mean other than he thinks maybe they could get Sean Payton?
I'm sitting over here and I'm brainstorming. I'm trying to think of what do I make of this? And I think there's a tremendous amount of irony to earlier in the show, we talked about Sean Payton and the call, the NFL not making a statement about them losing. If Sean Payton wins that game, do y'all think we have the same subject as Sean Payton potentially being a Dallas Cowboy coach? If they win that game,
if they're still playing?
If they're still playing.
If they're still playing, no.
Oh, so I'm wondering. Like, I mean, would we still? I don't think we would have.
No, I mean, I think that the conversation started before the game, and so the conversation about Sean Payton potentially leaving New Orleans started. I think it would be happening, irrespective of whether the Saints win the Super Bowl, losing the Super Bowl, or losing the NFC Championship.
I think there's two people that can end it. You guys hit the first person, Jerry Jones. They asked him on the show. He didn't say anything. Mm. Sean Payton's the other person. There's a reason why Sean Payton hadn't dismiss this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He likes his name to be out there. Mm-hmm. Also, Sean Payton lost that game, and some of that responsibility in New Orleans against the Rams, it's on him. So if I'm able to move the goalpost a little bit, they won't be talking about me throwing the ball on first down. Mm-hmm. They won't be talking about my decision-making. I lost that game in overtime. Let's be able to talk about something else that is a little more distraction. I don't think it's a real possibility right now. Making $9 million a year, working for Gail Benson. Her late husband, Tom Benson, died less than 2 years ago. Mickey Loomis, that's his right-hand man. That's who he's communicating with. Compared to doing business with Stephen Jones, Jerry Jones, compared to who he's doing business with now, I just find it hard to believe, as long as I've been around this league, to believe that there's a lot of truth to this.
Let me ask you this, C, real quick. Sorry, Kenny. Because I know that Bill Parcells is one of your guys, and there is nobody that's a bigger Bill Parcells guy than Sean Payton. Obviously, Bill Parcells was your
coach. He's my guy, yeah. He drafted me.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
drafted
so that's
you.
My guy.
So, you guys, what do each of you think Bill Parcells would say if Sean Payton had this opportunity? Sean Payton said, hey, what's being the head coach of that team like? What are the positives? What are the negatives? What do you think Bill Parcells would tell him?
Well, when Parcells was the head coach in Dallas, they pretty much let him run the show. I mean, he
different
was the one that ran the draft. It wasn't Jerry or Stephen Jones.
Yep.
They gave him full autonomy, and Jeff Ireland was his right-hand man. So I think a part of why Parcells walked away from that Cowboys job is because
Jeff Ireland is still the right-hand man, Mickey Loomis, in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So there is some combination connective tissue.
Go Absolutely. Ahead. And so I think a part of why Bill Parcells decided to leave was because Jerry Jones was trying to insert himself in football decisions. So there always is that tendency for Jerry to get involved in football business, and that might not be something that Sean is interested in. But Bill Parcells also believed that it's better to leave a job early as opposed to leaving a job a year late.
Yes.
And that's why Bill never stayed at any job longer than 8 seasons. Bill would go in there, he'd turn a franchise around, and he'd move on. I mean, he's been the head coach 5 different franchises, and he's always left early. So I look at this situation and say, because they've done such a good job drafting in New Orleans the last couple of years and developing a young nucleus, even though Drew Brees is probably going to walk away in the next couple of seasons, I think Sean Payton feels good about where this roster is right now. And, of course, they gave him the contract extension, so it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for me for Sean Payton to leave that situation to go deal with the Dallas Cowboys, because that is one of the jobs in the NFL that does have some moving parts because of the owner.
Just quickly, though, if Sean Payton came in, would he be more Jason Garrett or more Bill Parcells?
No, he would only come in as Bill Parcells. He would only come in with full control, and that was going to be the next thing I asked, which is, you wonder if this is a possibility, if Jerry Jones is looking back and saying, you know what? We had a good thing going with Bill Parcells, that you guys should have won that playoff game with the Romo fumbled. I apologize. People like that. They had good teams. They could have gone on a real run. Maybe Jerry, when he is desperate to win a Super Bowl, would say, I'm gonna hire a guy who I can empower more so than I've empowered any coach since Bill Parcells.
All right. Kenny, stick around. Coming up, how big of a challenge is Sean McVay facing in Super Bowl 53? We discuss next on First Things First. Back here with Chris Kenny, time for Say What? Rob Gronkowski will try to eliminate all distractions during the lead up to Super Bowl 53, but his cell phone could keep him from his third Lombardi trophy. Say what?
I was reading this group chat. You want to see what it was? Yeah. Oh, you'll lose your mind.
You coach Belichick, Tom?
No. A different group chat. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Kind of want to show you. Probably be in trouble.
Gronk would, if the NFL asked for Gronk's phone, he's destroying it like Brady, but destroying for totally it. Different reasons. Totally.
There's a lot of incriminating evidence.
Yeah,
on that
just
phone.
But nothing about deflating footballs on it.
Not that.
This could be the last football game we see Rob Gronkowski playing.
Maybe.
A week from Sunday. I'd say it's a 50-50 proposition at best. Like, I'm sure that prop bet's out there. One of the hundreds of prop bets for the Super Bowl. I don't wish that upon him, but when he thought about retiring this offseason, played another year.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if he retired after the game.
Rams head coach Sean McVay celebrated his 33rd birthday yesterday, the youngest coach to lead his team to a Super Bowl. Among the other ways he celebrated, game planning against the best coach quarterback in NFL history. That coach is Bill Belichick. Belichick is 66 years old. McVay is 33 years old. That age gap is the largest ever between Super Bowl head coaches. You saw what I did there, Nick. I just split that in half and I did the math
good,
in my
quick
head.
Match.
Nicely here, done.
Thank you, guys. You're the best. Here's what Sean McVay had to say about facing New England.
It's a great challenge for our football team because these guys are the epitome of, you know, really the standard, the consistency at which you operate. And, you know, I think, you know, Coach Belichick, you know, he certainly has had a lot of success on defense, but he's been instrumental in offense, special teams. So, you know, his success speaks for itself. And like I've said before, I'm a fan of coaching. I have so much respect for the Patriots organization, the way they operate, the way that he consistently leads, puts his players in positions to really have success. And then, you know, that's something it's an incredible opportunity for us to compete against them. Our players have earned the right to be able to play in this game. Our coaches have done a great job. And really, it's about the Rams versus the Patriots doing an excellent job with that. But to get a chance to go against a team and an organization like this is something that we're excited about. But you have a lot of respect for them.
All right, Chris Kenny, what is the biggest challenge that Sean McVay is going to face come Super Bowl time?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, Jenna. First and foremost, it has to be the X's and O's and Bill Belichick having the experience on Sean McVay. Bill Belichick has been around pro football for 4 decades. So, I mean, he's just got more information. He's got more answers for his team. And you got to believe that Bill Belichick is going to throw something at Sean McVay that he hadn't seen the Patriots do all season long. So you have to be ready for that. But also, from a logistics standpoint, just how to best utilize these next 2 weeks to get your football team ready to go on Super Bowl Sunday, because it is different, because you do have a bye week in there. How do I best prepare and get my guys ready to go by the time that game rolls around?
And you don't just mean X's and O's.
No, I don't mean X's and O's. I mean, from a schedule standpoint, how do you handle the week, the game plan, and the install? I felt like one of the big advantages that we had on that Super Bowl 46 team with the Giants was that the core of guys that we had on that team was the same core from the Super Bowl 42 team when they beat the undefeated New England Patriots in Arizona. So those guys understanding how to handle the week, knowing that we needed to install the majority of the game plan before we traveled to the Super Bowl site, those types of things are important because once you get to the Super Bowl city, there are going to be a lot of responsibilities for that for those players. You got media day. You've got people pulling you in a bunch of different directions. The best thing that you can do for your football team is to make sure that everybody is familiar and comfortable with the game plan. So when you go there, you're just sharpening everything up and just trying to build to get to the big game. CC, we talked about that in Super Bowl 46 when you guys interviewed me in Indianapolis. And we were just talking about the importance of making sure that this week was more of the mental week, the preparation week. Last week, we got all the physical work as far as our game plan install done. So I think that's going to be something that's important for Sean McVay, how he handles the next 2 weeks with his young team. Because a lot of guys on that team for the Rams, this is their first rodeo. So they don't understand what this is all about. The Patriots got a lot of experience doing it. This is their fourth trip to the Super Bowl in the last 5 years.
Trying to recall some of those things we also talked about. I do vaguely remember you and your teammates, though, y'all came up with a pack as far as what y'all were going to do Super Bowl week, as far as what y'all weren't going to hang out. Right?
I can't believe you remember that. Yeah, we absolutely did. That was one of the things that we had discussed. The guys that were on that Giants team, they said, listen, the parties after you win the Super Bowl are a lot better than the parties before the Super Bowl when you're doing when you're there at the city during that week. So it was a situation where we had a little bit of fun right before we left to go to the Super Bowl site. But when we were at the Super Bowl city, it was all business. Nobody was hanging out.
What city was that?
Indianapolis. Indianapolis. So
it's not
as much temptation as Atlanta.
In Atlanta, just for whatever it's worth.
But exactly. But
what
that
do you
was.
Mean, Nick?
It was just
experience. Don't tell on yourself, Nick. But that was one of the things that was important to us as a team. Like, we wanted to be accountable to each other because we knew in order to play our best football, we couldn't be hanging out during that week.
So I'm going to go to the biggest challenge. And Sean McVay, he's really done a great job. They attack free agency. Him and Les Snead, the general manager there, they've done a tremendous job. They went out to some veteran players. And to me, they didn't go after guys who had the wrong characteristics to bring into the locker room. All of them were hard workers. All of them were high achievers. And there was individual skill that each of them could do that was a great asset to what the Rams needed, from either Sue to Peters to Leap. All of them.
Cooks, they were all blue chippers as well, all first-round picks. All
what I'm concerned about is, do they have the brotherhood that I heard you talk about? I interviewed, and then I saw how it worked on the game. I watched the Buffalo Bills, and I can tell you how they lost four Super Bowls. It wasn't scheme. They tried to party too much every single Super Bowl, believing that they could treat that Super Bowl a lot like they did the regular season. And what they did in the regular season, they partied and they won a bunch of games. But in the postseason, you can't do that. Can Sean McVay get these renegade, one a year, rent-a-cops?
Mm-hmm. Mercenaries.
Can he get these guys focused for that first week? And that's the week they were in Los Angeles, when they flew back from New Orleans, when people were meeting them at the airport and all the distractions. Because I saw the New York football Giants. I saw the commitment. It's different than a game plan. I'm committed to you, man. Mm-hmm. I'm going to not do those things this week so that we can lift up that Lombardi trophy. To me, that's the biggest task that Sean McVay has in trying to control them to get them to Atlanta.
Right. And so
focused.
So that all of what you guys are talking about, the majority is everything that up until around 6:40 Eastern, a week from Sunday, when the game actually kicks off. And then once the game actually kicks off, the question's going to be for Sean McVay and that offense, can they adjust to whatever it is, those wrinkles, those things Bill Belichick's putting out there hasn't shown all year, quicker than the Patriots' previous two opponents did. The Chargers never were able to adjust. Game was over. It's 35-7 at halftime. Good night. The Chiefs took the whole first half to adjust. They had run 16 plays for 32 yards in that first half. Now, they made a game of it. The second half actually took the lead, but they had dug themselves ultimately too big of a hole. How long will it take for the Pats or for the Rams to adjust to that? And do the Rams offer up the Patriots anything? they have to adjust to, because the Rams' offense has been a predictable one. We know they're going to be an 11 personnel. We're not going to have three wide receivers, one tight end, one running back. We know that so much of what they do pre-snap is really just to set up their play action, and we have to assume Todd Gurley's going to be a full go, or else the Rams are in really rough shape. So let's just assume that he's healthy by then. We know so much is set up around their best offensive player, Todd Gurley, and we also know their next best offensive player, Brandon Cooks. The Patriots got a book on him now. Now, maybe he has a book on their corners to go along with it, but he was in that building a year ago, so they know what he does and doesn't do. This is another time where, as far as how you deal with the elongated halftime, how you deal with some of the things you guys are talking about, where Sean McVay will have to lean on the guy, one of his first hires, Wade Phillips, who's coached in Super Bowls, who's been a part of teams that had that won a Super Bowl just a few years ago with the Broncos. That team did have some Super Bowl experience from their loss to the Seattle Seahawks a couple years prior.
Yep, that challenge of that first week, that is the number one challenge. And then, as you said, Nick, it's seriously about the X's and O's and Jared Goff. New England Patriots have won 18 straight games against quarterbacks 25 and under. Jared Goff is 24. So those X's and O's become very, very important. They're not more important than that first lead up to that week of practice in the host city.
Chris Caney, how much can the Rams learn from what the Eagles did against the Patriots in the Super Bowl last year?
Well, I think you see one of the formulas for being able to beat a Tom Brady-led team is being able to get pressure on Tom Brady in the middle of that offensive line. And so I think the Rams are equipped to do that with Aaron Donald and Ndamukong Suh, but it's just a matter of how they're going to be able to adjust, because Bill Belichick is going to have a plan in terms of trying to neutralize what those guys do. A big part of that plan will be that Patriots passing attack getting the ball out on time. Tom Brady's going to get the ball out of his hands in 2.5 seconds. That group up front for the Rams, they have to be patient and understand that we've got to continue to come at him, knowing that there will be opportunities eventually in the game. You just got to be able to capitalize on them. That was one of the things we were able to do with the Giants. We kept coming at Tom Brady. We had waves of defensive line. We were 8 deep that year, and that's what we were able to do. We were able to wear down that Patriots offensive line. So once we got into the fourth quarter, when those critical plays needed to be made, much like what happened with Brandon Graham last year in that 2-minute drill, we were able to make those plays.
And the way you guys did it, and not that there's a great recipe for beating the Pats in the playoffs, they only lost 10 playoff games. It's been the more duplicable one. You know, trying to get after Brady and hold down the offense, that's how the Pats have lost 8 of their 10 playoff games in this era, which is an amazing number. That only twice has a team said, we're going to outscore you. Last year's Super Bowl and the 06 AFC Championship game when Peyton Manning executed a spectacular second-half comeback. All the other ones, you've held the Pats to 21 or nothing, and you've really been able to choke out their offense. That, I think, will be what the Rams attempt to do.
Chris, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.